Hello, listeners. You're listening to Earth Matters. My name is Kieran Stewart Ashton. I'm going to be your host today. This episode was recorded up on the south coast of New South Wales on what is Yuin Country and was produced in studios of 3CR down in Naarm, or Melbourne as it's otherwise known today, on the lands of the Kulin Nation. I'd like to pay my respect to the First Nations people, not only of the Yuin and the Kulin Nations, but of this whole entire continent. Today we are going to be talking a bit about a major issue today, actually. We're going to be talking a bit about toxic waste and how it ends up on stolen lands. So to have this discussion, we're going to be looking at two different areas. We're going to be looking at a truth that very rarely makes headlines as well, but a truth that has shaped the lives of many First Nations communities. Now, whether it's radioactive scars that have been left by British nuclear tests out in the desert, whether it's uranium mines leaking tailings into sacred waterways, or whether it's the slow poisoning of country with new forever chemicals like PFAS, the story is always the same. Governments and corporations making decisions about waste, but it's Indigenous communities who are forced to live with the consequences of those decisions. Now, this isn't just about pollution. It's also about sovereignty. It's about the right to live safe, and it's about the right to live healthy lives on our own country, and also the way that colonization continues to treat our lands and our waters as sacrifice zones. So over the next 20 or so minutes, we'll explore how this plays out across the continent, from nuclear contamination in South Australia and the Northern Territory, to PFAS chemicals creeping into water systems in places like Jervis Bay and the Blue Mountains. We will look at how these poisons disrupt not just health, but also culture, food systems, and our spiritual connection to country. And we will ask, how did these decisions get made? Who benefits and who pays the price? And what does justice look like when whole communities are left to shoulder the toxic legacy of a system that was never built for them? Now, first off, we need to set the context here. You know, these aren't accidents or isolated cases. The pattern of toxic waste on stolen land comes straight out of the colonial worldview. From the moment of invasion, this continent was treated as empty, as terra nullius, and as a resource to be dug up, poisoned, and exploited. Once you strip land of its law and its custodians, it becomes easier to see it as disposable. That's why radioactive waste from nuclear testing was dumped in the deserts of South Australia. That's why uranium mines were carved into sacred sites in the Northern Territory. And that's why defence bases and industry have been allowed to leach PFAS chemicals into rivers, wetlands and groundwater right next to Aboriginal communities. In every case, the logic is the same. The state and corporations decide what is safe enough for our country without ever asking us, without ever seeking true consent. And when communities do raise alarms, when cancers spread or water turns undrinkable, we're told to wait, to trust the same institutions that caused the problem in the first place. Now, this stands in complete opposition to First Nations law. Our connection to country is not something that can be measured in profit margins or contamination levels. It is a relationship of reciprocity and care. Land and waters are kin, not dumping grounds. Poisoning them isn't just an environmental issue, it's cultural destruction, it's a violation of law, and it's another chapter in the story of colonization. So as we dive into the examples of nuclear waste and PFAS contamination, we need to keep this frame in mind. Toxic waste isn't just bad management. It's the continuation of a colonial system that sacrifices Indigenous lives and lands so others can profit. Now, let's start off first with nuclear waste. Australia has a long and a painful history of radioactive contamination, and almost every site tells the same story. First Nations country chosen as the sacrifice zone. Take Maralinga and Emu Field in South Australia. Now, these were the sites of British nuclear weapons tests back in the 1950s and 60s. For decades, the government denied the extent of the contamination. The Anangu people were pushed off their lands, families ended up scattered, and when they finally returned, they found that country was scarred and poisoned. Even after so-called clean-up efforts, radioactive waste remains buried in shallow pits, and generations are still dealing with the fallout of tests that they never consented to. Or look at Lucas Heights up in Sydney, for example. It's Australia's only nuclear reactor, producing radioactive waste that still has no permanent home. For years now, governments have tried to push the problem onto First Nations lands, most recently at Kimber in the Flinders Ranges. And I apologise if I mispronounce this, I'm not familiar with these people, but the Barngala people opposed the dump at every step of the way. They were arguing that they were excluded from the consultation process and that their cultural heritage was actually at risk. Now, back in 2023, the federal court agreed, throwing out the decision. It was, you know, a landmark case for us. And for once, you know, community resistance actually forced the government to back down. Then there's also places like the Northern Territory. You know, you've got the old Rum Jungle uranium mine, which left toxic legacy, and it left a lot of toxic waste still leaking into rivers and wetlands. Now, there is a rehabilitation project underway with the local First Nation people involved in that, but it's a reminder that mines can leave scars that last generations, and they can cause ongoing issues over several generations for our people. And, you know, as on top of that as well, look at Ranger and Jabiluku up in Kakadu, on the Mirar country. Now, Ranger has closed and is supposedly rehabilitated, but there are still very serious and real concerns there about whether that work will meet the cultural and environmental standards that are set by the traditional owners up there. And Jabiluka, which the Mirar fought hard to stop, is a reminder of how much pressure governments and companies will apply to force uranium projects onto country. Now, what ties these stories together is clear. It's radioactive contamination isn't some distant or historic issue. It's very much real, serious, and ongoing today. And it's always targeted at lands and peoples that the colonial powers consider expendable. Now, when we are talking about uranium mining and nuclear testing and radioactive waste, it's easy for the conversation to get stuck on technical language, you know, stuff like radiation levels, contamination standards, rehabilitation targets, and, you know, all of this other jargon. But what really matters is how this contamination shows up in people's lives. Now, when we look at places like Maralinga and Emu Field, what we see is Aboriginal families with cancers, with birth defects, and unexplained illnesses that stretch right back long before the government admitted that there was actually anything wrong. You know, people who scavenged scrap metal from test sites or who were forced to drink from contaminated water holes end up paying with their health. Elders have spoken of strange sores, of issues like blindness and premature deaths, or in the following years after those nuclear tests were undertaken. Now, when we look at places like around Rum Jungle, the toxic runoff polluted the East Finnis River for decades. Now, local people there who relied on fish and relied on water from that river lost not just the food source, but their health. You know, all that heavy metal exposure is linked to stuff like kidney diseases. It's linked to neurological issues and developmental problems in children. And these aren't abstract risks, you know, they are lived realities for these people. Up in Kakadu, the Mirar people have been for many years now raising concerns about the dust and the water contamination, as well as the radioactive waste from the Ranger mine. Now, workers and families that were living near the site have also long reported higher rates of illness. Now, for the Mirar, the damage isn't just to physical health, but it's also to cultural health. Now, don't get me wrong, there is a lot of physical health issues there, but it's beyond just physical health. It's also impacts to our cultural and social health as well. You know, when you've got contaminated water, it means you can't hunt, you can't fish, or you can't gather safely. So that kind of disruption severs law, it severs ceremony, it severs connection to country, and it prevents the ability to pass on that knowledge, which is, you know, at least 60,000 years old, if not tens of thousands more. It severs that ability to pass on that knowledge to the next generation and to be able to practice culture as we have been for, you know, 60,000 or more years. Now, on top of that, you know, it's also impacts our physical health. When you can't go out and have a healthy diet from hunting and gathering, you have to rely on, especially out there in the middle of the Northern Territory, you know, you have to rely on food being brought in, which is quite often canned food or food that's filled with preservatives and sugars and all of these other additives that end up causing drastic health impacts for us, especially for the mob out there who for, you know, 60,000 or more years haven't actually been exposed in their diet to stuff like processed sugars and to all of these other preservatives. And as a result, you know, their body simply can't handle it. They end up with massive rates of stuff like diabetes and different tumors and, you know, all of these other impacts on their physical health from that disruption to being able to practice culture and hunt and gather. Now, all across all of these sites, one thing stands out, which is that governments and corporations have been slow to listen, if they listen at all. Communities out there are told that their illnesses are just coincidence or unproven. Health studies are delayed or deliberately underfunded by the government and by corporations so that there is no concrete evidence to be able to, you know, prove what's wrong. Although, you know, the concrete evidence is out there. If you go to any of those communities, you can see for yourself the amount of people that are suffering as a result of all this contamination. And meanwhile, you've got generations of Aboriginal families who end up having to carry this burden. You know, they carry it in their bodies, in their health, in their grief, and in their ongoing struggle to be able to heal their country and practice their culture. So when we hear officials promise that a new waste facility will be safe or that rehabilitation will make everything right, history actually tells us otherwise. You know, the health costs are real and they are intergenerational. Now, next I'm going to talk a bit about PFAS. Now, if you don't know what PFAS is, it is something that is very much already in our blood, in our soils, and in our waterways. And when I say I don't just mean First Nations people, I mean everybody who calls this continent home. Although the levels do vary, of course, between different demographics. Now, PFAS, or PFAS, stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Now, it's a group of synthetic chemicals that don't break down in the environment, which is why they're called forever chemicals. Now, they've been used for decades in stuff like firefighting foams, in nonstick cookware, in textiles, and in various industrial processes. Once they're released into water or soil, they stay there. They seep into the fish, the plants, the animals, and ultimately into us. Now, this isn't just science talk for me. I'm actually traditionally from Wreck Bay. I've lived there quite a lot of my life. And I've actually seen firsthand the way that PFAS creeps into our lives. Now, defence sites around Wreck Bay, out at Jervis Bay there, HMAS Creswell, have been using these firefighting foams for decades now. And my own community has had to deal with the contamination, with the health impacts, and with the long fight for justice. Now, this is actually something I spoke about in one of my very first Earth Matters shows earlier in the year. If you want, you can head to the website, freecr.org.au/Earth Matters, and there you can find that earlier episode. If you haven't listened to it, please do go back and listen to that one. It's a very important episode. Now, back then, I spoke about it mostly from the point of view of Wreck Bay, although now I'm going to talk about it a bit more generally. Now, PFAS is something that is going to, well, it actually is, it's not going to be. You know, it is one of the biggest environmental scandals of our time. The more you look into it, the more you find it. It's pretty much everywhere now in lower quantities. It's in our drinking water, it's right through our food systems, it's in the bodies of our kids. And again, when I'm saying our, I'm not just talking about the people of Wreck Bay or First Nations people, I'm talking about everybody on this continent. In fact, it's so prevalent right throughout the environment that I was reading a recent study, and the sea spray that you get off of waves when they break, the sea spray today actually has more PFAS in it than what you'll find coming out of the big chimney stacks over at the 3M plants where they make this chemical. You know, it's that's how prevalent it is today. It's everywhere. It's in our rainwater. It's in all of our drinking water. It's, you know, right through everybody's bodies. There was actually a recent study a few months back, I think by the ABC, where they found that it was pretty much in everyone's bodies now in lower quantities. Now, it is only going to get worse because it is that forever chemical. It doesn't break down. Like stuff like mercury, you know, if you know about mercury and the impact that mercury has in the environment, the way it just builds up over time, you know, PFAS, is pretty much the same sort of deal. It's something that just continues to build up and build up and build up, and it only gets worse and worse as time goes by. Now, another really great reference or resource, I should say, for this is there's a documentary on Stan called How to Poison a Planet. Now, if you've seen it, you'll know that this isn't just an Australian issue, it's a global issue. But if you haven't seen that documentary, I do recommend you watch that as well. It talks a lot about the health impacts that happened around the factories, the 3M factories over in the United States, where this chemical is predominantly made, as well as a bit of a case study on Wreck Bay itself. Wreck Bay is an Aboriginal community up on the south coast where it's right next to a naval base, and at this naval base they used firefighting foams that had these chemicals for decades. And as a result now, my community out there, Wreck Bay, we've got the highest cancer rates in recorded Australian history because of this chemical. And, you know, that's just the cancer. There's a whole bunch of other problems as well. You know, we've got these, you know, extraordinarily high rates of stuff like birth defects and of, you know, other birth complications, of stuff like sterility, of, you know, eczema and asthma, and, you know, the list just goes on and on. Like, there's liver disease, there's lung diseases, all of these different illnesses that we've got some of, if not the highest rates in Australian history, all as a direct result of this chemical. You know, it's absolutely disgusting. It's something that people need to be more aware of. And, you know, what makes it so dangerous is how invisible it is and how it's just literally everywhere, how it undermines the very foundations of health as well. Yeah, something to really look into. But yeah, you know, even though this issue has been something that has been impacting my Aboriginal community for decades now, it is now becoming a bit more mainstream. So when we talk about PFAS in Australia, for many people it can feel like something that is distant, but the truth is already right here in places like the Blue Mountains as well. So recently, Sydney Water actually had to flush one of its reservoirs after these PFAS chemicals were detected in it. Now, the contamination was traced to places like Medlow Dam and Greaves Creek Dam, which feed into the Cascade Water Filtration Plant. Authorities there ended up disconnecting those dams from the supply altogether because PFAS levels in the raw water were above the national guidelines. Now, again, you know, I've said this many times, but there is no such thing as a safe level of PFAS to consume. Many countries, especially in the EU, have already acknowledged this. Unfortunately, Australia is still playing catch up and, you know, still has a so-called safe drinking level in their national guidelines. But the PFAS up in this raw water was even above those national guidelines. Now, officials are saying that by the time the water passes through the Cascade plant, it still meets the standards for drinking water. But, you know, we have to be honest here. When your own dam has to be flushed, and when people are finding PFAS showing up in catchments and creeks, you know, the reassurance doesn't feel very solid. You know, we know this from experience at Wreck Bay, but, you know, other people are starting to feel this, you know, feel this unease and tension around this stuff as well. And communities in the Blue Mountains have every right to be worried about this. You know, some residents have even gone so far as to get their own blood test because they don't trust that the system will tell them the whole story. And, you know, the likely sources for this PFAS aren't mysterious at the end of the day. You know, investigators have found that, you know, a lot of the sources of this are from old firefighting foams that were sprayed in the area, as well as local fire brigade stations that once stored these foams. You know, it's not ancient history either. It's everyday decisions that are piling up over time that leave a toxic footprint on the land. Now, from a First Nations perspective, this isn't just about whether the tap water is technically safe or not. It's about trust. You know, it's about the impact it's having on our country. And it's about what happens when waterways become places of risk instead of sources of life. You know, once a creek or a dam is poisoned, you lose more than just drinking water. You lose your bush foods that rely on the water from that. You lose your medicines. You lose your ability to be able to practice culture out there. And along with that, the spiritual relationship that comes with caring for those waterways and, you know, practicing that culture and living off of the land as we have for 60,000 or more years. So what's happening in the Blue Mountains is bigger than just one reservoir being flushed. It's another example of how PFAS, just like nuclear waste, turns our country into a dumping ground, and how communities are left with the impossible task of proving harm while the authorities scramble to contain it. But, you know, again, it's a lot bigger than just my community or bigger than the Blue Mountains. You know, it's turning up right across the continent, actually. And one of the most recent flashpoints is at Brogans Creek in the central west of New South Wales. Now, the site out there was once used by the chemical giant 3M to test its products. And what's been left behind is another one of these toxic legacies. The New South Wales EPA has had to step in and issue cleanup orders after these chemicals were found leaching from the old quarry. Now, for locals out there, it's not just a matter of, you know, paperwork. It means that their soil, their water, their livelihoods are being tainted by chemicals that should never have been allowed to spread in the first place. And, you know, if that sounds familiar, it's because it follows the same pattern we've seen over and over and over again. A multinational corporation profits for decades, then walks away, leaving communities to live with these consequences. Now, in response to mounting pressure, the government has finally started to act, finally. So, since July of this year, you know, Australia has banned the manufacture, the import, and the export, and the use of three of the most dangerous of these PFAS chemicals. And there's a new National Environmental Management Plan, which tries to guide how states deal with the contamination from this. Now, you know, on paper, that sounds like progress. But the real problem is that, you know, these bans don't magically remove the PFAS that's already in our rivers and soils, as well as, you know, that's coming down in our rain and coming from the sea spray and, you know, continuing to build up in the environment. And these management plans don't heal the damage that has already been done to communities who have been living with this contamination for years, who have been drinking it and eating it and, you know, consuming it in other ways. And these same communities, which are very often First Nations communities, are still waiting for clear answers. You know, they're still waiting for stuff like health monitoring, and they're still waiting for genuine accountability. So while politicians are out here celebrating these reforms, you know, we know that the people on the ground are still asking the same questions. They're still looking for who is responsible, who will clean the mess up, and how do you repair the damage when the damage doesn't go away. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Earth Matters, and today on today's episode, we're looking at the impacts of PFAS and nuclear waste on communities and on health and on country and all of these different issues. But, you know, to get back into the discussion, you know, when we step back and we look at both nuclear contamination and PFAS contamination, you know, the common threads become impossible for people to actually ignore here. In every single case, the land that gets chosen for dumping, mining, or contamination is land that is seen as expendable. And in this colony, that usually means Aboriginal land. You know, whether it's the deserts that are being scarred by nuclear tests, or the waterways carrying these forever chemicals into our bodies, the decision is always the same. You know, sacrifice Indigenous country for the convenience of some big multinational corporation. The impacts aren't just physical, as I discussed earlier, they're cultural, they're spiritual, they're intergenerational. When water is poisoned, it's not only unsafe to drink, it can no longer sustain the fish, the bush foods, the bush medicines, and you know, all these other things that our cultures have relied on for tens of thousands of years. When land ends up contaminated, our ceremony and our connection end up being broken as a result, or at the very least, you know, severely impacted. The poison seeps into every part of our life, whether it's our health, our community, our law, our culture, and our identity. You know, it's everywhere. And then there's also the trust, or I should say the lack of, you know, because time and time again, governments and corporations, you know, they reassure us that everything is apparently under control and that the risks are within their so-called guidelines, and, you know, that rehabilitation will fix it. But history always shows us otherwise. Whether it's Maralinga, whether it's Rum Jungle, whether it's Ranger, whether it's Wreck Bay or the Blue Mountains, you know, each and every one of those is a reminder that the system doesn't tell the truth until communities find the truth out for themselves. So these aren't just environmental issues, they're colonial issues, they're sovereignty issues, and they show us how a system built on dispossession keeps on reproducing those same acts of dispossession, not just through land theft, but through toxic legacies that shape the lives of our people for several generations. This toxic waste on stolen land isn't just a mistake, and it isn't just a coincidence, but it's a recurring pattern. A pattern that shows us how colonization keeps working, how governments and corporations treat our country as a dumping ground, and how First Nations communities are often the ones forced to carry the burden in our bodies, in our waters, in our food, and in our cultures. Our people have never accepted this quietly, though. You know, from the Mirai resisting uranium mines, to the Bangala mob defeating the Kimber dump, to communities like my own at Wreck Bay and up in the Blue Mountains demanding answers on PFAS, we continue to stand up and we continue to say that our country is not expendable. Sovereignty is non-negotiable, and the fight for justice means holding those who poison our lands accountable. Quick shout out to the Community Broadcasting Foundation, as well as to 3CR down in Naarm, where this show is produced. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Until then, have a good one.